1. 28 Articles, Fundamentals of Company-Level Counterinsurgency. Your company has just been warned for deployment on counterinsurgency operations in Iraq or Afghanistan. You have read David Galula, T.E. Lawrence, and Robert Thompson. You have studied FM 324 and now understand the history, philosophy, and theory of counterinsurgency. You have watched Black Hawk Down and the Battle of Algiers, and you know this will be the most difficult challenge of your life. But what does all the theory mean at the company level? How do the principles translate into action at night, with the GPS down, the media criticizing you, the locals complaining in a language you don't understand, and an unseen enemy killing your people by ones and twos? How does counterinsurgency actually happen? There are no universal answers, and insurgents are among the most adaptive opponents you will ever face. Countering them will demand every ounce of your intellect, but be comforted. You are not the first to feel this way. There are tactical fundamentals you can apply to link the theory with the techniques and procedures you already know. What is counterinsurgency? If you have not studied counterinsurgency theory, here it is in a nutshell. This is a competition with the insurgent for the right and the ability to win the hearts, minds, and acquiescence of the population. You are being sent in because the insurgents, at their strongest, can defeat anything weaker than you. But you have more combat power than you can or should use in most situations. Injudicious use of firepower creates blood feuds, homeless people, and societal disruption that fuels and perpetuates the insurgency. The most beneficial actions are often local politics, civic action, and beat cop behaviors. For your side to win, the people do not have to like you, but they must respect you, accept that your actions benefit them, and trust your integrity and ability to deliver on promises, particularly regarding their security. In this battlefield, popular perceptions and rumor are more influential than the facts and more powerful than 100 tanks. Within this context, what follows are observations from collective experience, the distilled essence of what was learned by all of us who went before you. They are expressed as commandments for clarity, but they are really more like folklore. Apply them judiciously and skeptically. Preparation. Time is short during pre-deployment, but you will never have more time to think than you have now. Now is your chance to prepare yourself and your command. 1. Know your turf. Know the people, the topography, economy, history, religion, and culture. Know every village, road, field, population group, tribal leader, and ancient grievance. Your task is to become the world expert on your district. If you don't know precisely where you will be operating, study the general area. Read the map like a book. Study it every night before sleep and redraw it from memory every morning until you understand its patterns intuitively. Develop a mental model of your area, a framework in which to fit every new piece of knowledge you acquire. Study handover notes from predecessors. Better still, get in touch with the unit in theater and pick their brains. In an ideal world, intelligence officers and area experts would brief you. This rarely happens, and even if it does, there is no substitute for personal mastery. Understand the broader area of influence. This can be a wide area, particularly when insurgents draw on global grievances. Share out aspects of the operational area among platoon leaders and NCOs. Have each individual develop a personal specialization and brief the others. Neglecting this knowledge will kill you. 2. Diagnose the problem. Once you know your area and its people, you can begin to diagnose the problem. Who are the insurgents? What drives them? What makes local leaders tick? Counterinsurgency is fundamentally a competition between many groups, each seeking to mobilize the population in support of its agenda. counterinsurgency is always more than two-sided. So you must understand what motivates the people and how to mobilize them. You need to know why and how the insurgents are getting followers. This means you need to know your real enemy, not a cardboard cutout. The enemy is adaptive, is resourceful, and probably grew up in the region where you will operate. The locals have known him since he was a boy. How long have they known you? Your worst opponent is not the psychopathic terrorist of Hollywood myth. It is the charismatic follow-me warrior who would make your best platoon leader. His followers are not misled or naive. Much of his success is due to bad government policies or security forces that alienate the population. Work this problem collectively with your platoon and squad leaders. Discuss ideas, explore the problem, understand what you are facing, and seek a consensus. If this sounds unmilitary, get over it. Once you are in theater, situations will arise too quickly for orders or even commanders' intent. Corporals and privates will have to make snap judgments with strategic impact. The only way to help them is to give them a shared understanding, then trust them to think for themselves on the day. 3. Organize for intelligence. In counterinsurgency, killing the enemy is easy. Finding him is often nearly impossible. Intelligence and operations are complementary. Your operations will be intelligence-driven, but intelligence will come mostly from your own operations, not as a product prepared and served up by higher headquarters. So you must organize for intelligence. You will need a company S2 and intelligence section, including analysts. Author's note, 2009. S2 refers to an intelligence staff officer or section in a headquarters. S3 refers to the operations staff. You may need platoon S2s and S3s, and you will need a reconnaissance and surveillance R&S element. You will not have enough linguists. You never do, but consider carefully where best to employ them. Linguists are a battle-winning asset, but like any other scarce resource, you must have a prioritized bump plan in case you lose them. Often during pre-deployment, the best use of linguists is to train your command in basic language. You will probably not get augmentation for all this, but you must still do it. Put the smartest soldiers in the S2 section and the R&S squad. You will have one less rifle squad, but the intelligence section will pay for itself in lives and effort saved. Author's note, 2009. Since this paper was written, enormous strides have been made in forward-deploying analysts to battalion and company level, pushing intelligence capability forward to field units, creating operations and/or intelligence fusion cells, and training combat units in the tactics, techniques, and procedures of information collection, reporting, and analysis. Nevertheless, most commanders in the field still find they need to put more effort than initially anticipated into intelligence work at the company level. Units that emphasize intelligence-led operations at the local level and structure each cycle of operations to generate actionable intelligence for the next still tend to do much better than units that wait for information from higher headquarters. 4. Organize for interagency operations. Almost everything in counterinsurgency is interagency, and everything important, from policing to intelligence to civil military operations to trash collection, will involve your company working with civilian actors and local indigenous partners you cannot control, but whose success is essential for yours. Train the company in interagency operations. Get a briefing from the State Department, aid agencies, and the local police or fire brigade. Train point men in each squad to deal with the interagency. Realize that civilians find rifles, helmets, and body armor intimidating. Learn how not to scare them. Ask others who come from that country or culture about your ideas. See it through the eyes of a civilian who knows nothing about the military. How would you react if foreigners came to your neighborhood and conducted the operations you planned? What if somebody came to your mother's house and did that? Most important, know that your operations will create temporary breathing space, but long-term development and stabilization by civilian agencies will ultimately win the war. 5. Travel light and harden your combat service support. You will be weighed down with body armor, rations, extra ammunition, communications gear, and 1,000 other things. The enemy will carry a rifle or RPG, a shamash, and a water bottle if he is lucky. Unless you ruthlessly lighten your load and enforce a culture of speed and mobility, the insurgents will consistently outrun and outmaneuver you. But in lightening your load, make sure you can always reach back to call for firepower or heavy support if needed. Also, remember to harden your CSS. The enemy will attack your weakest points. Most attacks on coalition forces in Iraq in 2004 and 2005, outside pre-planned combat actions like the two battles of Fallujah or Operation Iron Horse, were against CSS installations and convoys. You do the math. Ensure that your CSS assets are hardened, have communications, and are trained in combat operations. They may do more fighting than your rifle squads. 6. Find a political and/or cultural advisor. In a force optimized for counterinsurgency, you might receive a political-cultural advisor, POLAD, at company level. A diplomat or military foreign area officer able to speak the language and navigate the intricacies of local politics. Back on planet Earth, the corps and division commander will get a POLAD. You will not, so you must improvise. Find a political cultural advisor from among your people, perhaps an officer, perhaps not. Someone with people skills and a feel for the environment will do better than a political science graduate. Don't try to be your own cultural advisor. You must be fully aware of the political and cultural dimension, but this is a different task. Also, don't give one of your intelligence people this role. They can help, but their task is to understand the environment. The political advisor's job is to help shape it. Author's Note, 2009. Today, new capabilities exist to help combat units understand their environment. These include human terrain teams, female engagement teams, bilingual and/or bicultural advisors, and, in some places, tribal or community engagement cells. But these specialized capabilities cannot substitute for personal understanding of local languages, cultural norms, and local grassroots politics. Units whose leaders master these issues perform best. 7. Train the squad leaders, then trust them. Counterinsurgency is a squad and platoon leaders' war, and often a private soldier's war. Author's Note, 2009. This comment refers specifically to combat action, which is often fleeting and occurs at close range, so that only the local commander on the spot, almost always a junior officer or NCO, is able to influence the firefight as it unfolds. Brigade and battalion commanders have an extremely important longer-term role to play in synchronizing and queuing resources that set the conditions under which those junior commanders operate. This makes the platoon and squad the key tactical units and the brigade the key maneuver unit, especially in urban areas. In mountain and winter warfare, as in parts of Afghanistan for much of the year, the key maneuver unit is usually the battalion. Despite all this, the fundamental truth remains that the man on the spot with a gun, insurgent or counterinsurgent, at the start of a firefight, has the greatest influence on how that fight develops. Battles are won or lost in moments. Whoever can bring combat power to bear in seconds on a street corner will win. The commander on the spot controls the fight. You must train the squad leaders to act intelligently and independently without orders. If your squad leaders are competent, you can get away with average company or platoon staffs. The reverse is not the case. Training should focus on basic skills: marksmanship, patrolling, security on the move and at the halt, basic drills. When in doubt, spend less time on company and platoon training and more time on squads and individuals. Ruthlessly replace leaders who do not make the grade. But once people are trained and you have a shared operational diagnosis, you must trust them. We talk about this, but few company or platoon leaders really trust their people. In counterinsurgency, you have no choice. 8. Rank is nothing. Talent is everything. Not everyone is good at counterinsurgency. Many people don't understand the concept, and some who do can't execute it. It is difficult, and in a conventional force, only a few people will master it. Anyone can learn the basics, but a few naturals do exist. Learn how to spot these people and put them into positions where they can make a difference. Rank matters far less than talent. A few good men under a smart junior NCO can succeed in counterinsurgency, where hundreds of well-armed soldiers under a mediocre senior officer will fail. 9. Have a game plan. The final preparation task is to develop a game plan, a mental picture of how you see the operation developing. You will be tempted to try and do this too early, but force yourself to wait. As your knowledge improves, you will get a better idea both of what needs to be done and of your own limitations. Like any plan, this plan will change once you hit the ground and may need to be scrapped if there is a major shift in the environment. But you still need a plan, and the process of planning will give you a simple, robust idea of what to achieve, even if the methods change. At the very least, having a game plan allows you to know what you are deviating from. This is sometimes called operational design. One approach is to identify basic stages in your operation. For example, establish dominance, build local networks, marginalize the enemy. Make sure you can easily transition between phases, both forward and backward in case of setbacks. Just as the insurgent can adapt his activity to yours, you must have a simple enough plan to survive setbacks without collapsing. This plan is the solution that matches the shared diagnosis you developed earlier. It must be simple and known to everyone. The Golden Hour. You have deployed, completed reception and staging, and, if you are lucky, attended the in-country counterinsurgency school. Now it is time to enter your sector and start your tour. This is the Golden Hour. Mistakes made now will haunt you for the rest of the tour, while early successes will set the tone for victory. You will look back on your early actions and cringe at your clumsiness. So be it, but you must act. Author's Note, 2009. In 2006, General Casey had just established the Iraq Counterinsurgency Training Center at Taji, north of Baghdad. The school has since expanded and done excellent work for generations of coalition troops in Iraq, training the Surge Brigades in 2007 under the inspired leadership of Colonel Manny Deemer. An Iraqi Army counterinsurgency school was established on the same base in 2007 on the personal initiative of a highly independent junior Special Forces officer, Captain James Patrick, and is also performing well. In Afghanistan, the International Security Assistance Force Counterinsurgency Training Center was established outside Kabul in 2007. Founded by Captain Dan Helmer, it is currently led by Colonel John Agolia, an extremely capable and experienced counterinsurgent, a key member of the counterinsurgency underground in 2005 to 2006, and former head of the United States Army's Peacekeeping and Stabilization Operations Institute. This center provides training for coalition and Afghan personnel from all agencies, civilian and military. In both Afghanistan and Iraq, these centers are finishing schools, providing a final in-country polish to the pre-deployment training that people receive before arriving, and acting as centers of excellence and corporate knowledge for their respective theater of operations. 10. Be there. The first rule of deployment in counterinsurgency is to be there. You can almost never outrun the enemy in this environment. If you are not present when an incident happens, there is usually little you can do about it. So your first order of business is to establish presence. If you cannot do this throughout your sector, then do it wherever you can. This demands a residential approach, living in your sector, in close proximity to the population, rather than raiding into the area from remote, secure bases. Movement on foot, sleeping in local villages, night patrolling, all these seem more dangerous than they are. These techniques establish links with the locals, who see you as real people they can trust and do business with, not as aliens who descend from an armored box. Ultimately, they make the people your partners, and those partnerships become your first line of defense. Driving around in an armored convoy, day tripping like a tourist in hell, degrades situational awareness, makes you a target, and is ultimately more dangerous. 11. Avoid knee-jerk responses to first impressions. Don't act rashly. Get the facts first. The violence you see may be part of the insurgent strategy. It may be various interest groups fighting it out, or it may be people settling personal vendettas. Or it may just be daily life. Normality in Kandahar is not the same as in Kansas. So you need time to learn what normality looks like. Author's Note, 2009. Remember also that you are by far the most militarily powerful armed actor in the local people's environment, and they may use you to their advantage, portraying their local tribal, business, or political rivals as insurgents in order to mislead you into harsh actions that harm their rivals and strengthen their own position. This danger is much more acute in the early stages of a deployment, when you are still figuring out the key relationships among local people. In the words of a colleague in the Horn of Africa, as soon as you fly into one of these places, you've taken sides, and you don't even know it yet. The insurgent commander also wants to goad you into lashing out at the population or making a mistake. Unless you happen to be on the spot when an incident occurs, you will have only second-hand reports and may misunderstand the local context or interpretation. This fragmentation and disaggregation of the battlefield, particularly in urban areas, means that first impressions are often highly misleading. Of course, you cannot avoid making judgments, but if possible, check them with an older hand or a trusted local. If you can, keep one or two officers from your predecessor unit for the first part of the tour. Try to avoid a rush to judgment. Author's Note, 2009. Many units now send a few officers and NCOs forward to work with their predecessor unit in order to gain situational awareness. Other units have an offset rotation such that intelligence and civil affairs staffs rotate only half their people and at a different time from the main combat unit. Both these approaches work well. 12. Prepare for handover from day one. Believe it or not, you will not resolve the insurgency on your watch. Your tour will end, and your successors will need your corporate knowledge. Start handover folders in every platoon and specialist squad from day one. Ideally, you would have inherited these from your predecessors, but if not, you must start them. The folders should include lessons learned, details about the population, village and patrol reports, updated maps, photographs, anything that will help newcomers master the environment. Computerized databases are fine, but keep good backups and ensure you have hard copy of key artifacts and documents. This is boring, tedious, and essential. Over time, you will create a corporate memory that keeps your people alive. 13. Build trusted networks. Once you have settled into your sector, your next task is to build trusted networks. This is the true meaning of the phrase hearts and minds, which comprises two separate components. Hearts means persuading people their best interests are served by your success. Minds means convincing them that you can protect them and that resisting you is pointless. Note that neither concept has to do with whether people like you. Calculated self-interest, not emotion, is what counts. Over time, if you successfully build networks of trust, these will grow like roots into the population, displacing the enemy's networks, bringing him out into the open to fight you and seizing the initiative. These networks include local allies, community leaders, local security forces, NGOs, and other friendly or neutral non-state actors in your area, and the media. Conduct village and neighborhood surveys to identify needs in the community, then follow through to meet them, build common interests, and mobilize popular support. This is your true main effort. Everything else is secondary. Actions that help build trusted networks serve your cause. Actions, even killing high-profile targets, that undermine trust or disrupt your networks, help the enemy. Author's Note, 2009. Trust is a function of reliability. Indeed, in local languages in many parts of the world where we operate, the words for honor and reliability are similar or the same. Dependability is key. Local people must believe that you will follow through and deliver on promises in a reliable manner. Over time, the predictability and order that you create through dependability makes people feel safer and encourages them to work with you. Again, emotions are secondary here. If locals like you but believe you cannot be relied on, you come to seem pathetic to them. 14. Start easy. If you were trained in maneuver warfare, you know about surfaces and gaps. This applies to counterinsurgency as much as any other form of maneuver. Don't try to crack the hardest nut first. Don't go straight for the main insurgent stronghold. Try to provoke a decisive showdown or focus efforts on villages that support the insurgents. Instead, start from secure areas and work gradually outward. Do this by extending your influence through the locals' own networks. Go with, not against, the grain of local society. First, win the confidence of a few villages, and then see who they trade, intermarry, or do business with. Now, win these people over. Soon enough, the showdown with the insurgents will come. But now you have local allies, a mobilized population, and a trusted network at your back. Do it the other way around, and no one will mourn your failure. Author's Note, 2009. Indeed, the better you do in building a close relationship with the people, the more you threaten the enemy's connectivity with the population, from which insurgents draw their strength and freedom of action. This will bring the enemy to you like a magnet. They must fight to restore that linkage or be defeated, and they know it. Thus, a close relationship with the people provokes the enemy to attack both you and your local partners. This is inevitable and is actually a good thing because it allows you to control the terms of the engagement and brings the enemy into the open where they can be found, fixed, and destroyed with minimal collateral damage. As Colonel Chris Cavoli points out, this also helps the people see the insurgents as attackers and you as their protector, so that even if the enemy initiates the firefight, you win the political engagement. 15. Seek early victories. In this early phase, your aim is to stamp your dominance in your sector. Do this by seeking an early victory. This will probably not translate into a combat victory over the enemy. Looking for such a victory can be overly aggressive and create collateral damage, especially since you really do not yet understand your sector. Also, such a combat victory depends on the enemy being stupid enough to present you with a clear-cut target, a rare windfall in counterinsurgency. Instead, you may achieve a victory by resolving long-standing issues your predecessors have failed to address, or co-opting a key local leader who has resisted cooperation with our forces. Like any other form of armed propaganda, achieving even a small victory early in the tour sets the tone for what comes later and helps seize the initiative, which you have probably lost due to the inevitable hiatus entailed by the handover takeover with your predecessor. Author's Note 2009. The practice of district stabilization analysis is an important tool in identifying opportunities for early successes. Too often in the past, we have gone into districts with the attitude, "I am here to address all your grievances and fix all your problems." The problem with this is that in any given district there are dozens of problems, many of which are ancient or intractable grievances that cannot be fixed or may be beyond our current capacity. The approach of trying to find and fix problems thus tends to dissipate our effort in non-strategic activity. We go looking for problems, find them, and spend all our effort in addressing them in a haphazard way. District stabilization analysis takes a different approach. By first mapping grievances and issues and then boiling them down to grievances that, 1, are currently creating violence or instability, 2, are actually being exploited by the enemy, and 3, are things we can do something about in a meaningful time frame with current resources. With this analysis completed, units often find that the dozens of grievances are reduced to 2 or 3 issues they can address and that will actually have an impact in reducing instability and violence. The next step is equally important. Successful units do not stovepipe their efforts along lines of operation, such as security, governance, development, or essential services. Rather, they form multidisciplinary tiger teams to focus on each identified grievance and ensure that on each tiger team there is a security representative, a governance representative, a development representative, and so on. Units that are operating this way in Afghanistan and Iraq today tend to be doing much better than units that simply adopt a see grievance, fix grievance approach. 16. Practice deterrent patrolling. Establish patrolling methods that deter the enemy from attacking you. Often our patrolling approach seems designed to provoke, then defeat enemy attacks. This is counterproductive. It leads to a raiding, day-tripping mindset, or worse, a bunker mentality. Instead, practice deterrent patrolling. There are many methods for this, including multiple, also known as satellite patrolling, where you flood an area with numerous small patrols working together. Each is too small to be a worthwhile target, and the insurgents never know where all the patrols are, making an attack on any one patrol extremely risky. Other methods include so-called blue-green patrolling, where you mount daylight overt humanitarian patrols which go covert at night and hunt specific targets. Again, the aim is to keep the enemy off balance and the population reassured through constant and unpredictable activity, which, over time, deters attacks and creates a more permissive environment. A reasonable rule of thumb is that 1/3 to 2/3 of your force should be on patrol at any time, day or night. 17. Be prepared for setbacks. Setbacks are normal in counterinsurgency, as in every other form of war. You will make mistakes, lose people, or occasionally kill or detain the wrong person. You may fail in building or expanding networks. If this happens, don't lose heart. Simply drop back to the previous phase of your game plan and recover your balance. It is normal in company counterinsurgency operations for some platoons to be doing well while others do badly. This is not necessarily evidence of failure. Give local commanders the freedom to adjust their posture to local conditions. This creates elasticity that helps you survive setbacks. 18. Remember the global audience. One of the biggest differences between the counterinsurgencies our fathers fought and those we face today is the omnipresence of globalized media. Most houses in Iraq have one or more satellite dishes. Web bloggers, print, radio, and television reporters, and others are monitoring and commenting on your every move. When the insurgents ambush your patrols or set off a car bomb, They do so not to destroy one more track, but because they want graphic images of a burning vehicle and dead bodies for the evening news. Beware the scripted enemy who plays to a global audience and seeks to defeat you in the court of global public opinion. You counter this by training your people to always bear in mind the global audience, assume that everything they say or do will be publicized, and befriend the media. Get the press on side. Help them get their story and trade information with them. Good relationships with non-embedded media, especially indigenous media, dramatically increase your situational awareness and help get your message across to the global and local audience. 19. Engage the women, beware the children. Most insurgent fighters are men. But in traditional societies, women are hugely influential in forming the social networks that insurgents use for support. Co-opting neutral or friendly women through targeted social and economic programs builds networks of enlightened self-interest that eventually undermine the insurgents. You need your own female counterinsurgents, including interagency people, to do this effectively. Author's Note, 2009. The United States Marine Corps has created specialized female engagement teams, FETs, for operations in Afghanistan to engage with local women in the highly segregated Pashtun society in which Marines are operating today. Some commanders have also benefited greatly from the advice and insight on local opinion and networks that women counterinsurgents bring to the table due to their unique access. The FETs and similar Army teams operating under the Lioness program are extremely valuable in getting to the other 52% of the population with whom male counterinsurgents have a difficult time interacting. One key issue is the work rate and stress level of women operating in this role. In many cases, because of the constant need for female searchers and interviewers and the very limited number of women deployed in FETs, the women's work rate can spike dramatically beyond what was initially predicted, at the risk of exhaustion. The obvious long-term solution is to deploy more women in this role. In the interim, commanders need to watch the work rate, ensure adequate rest and recovery time for the FET, and watch for burnout. Win the women and you own the family unit. Own the family and you take a big step forward in mobilizing the population. Conversely, though, stop your people from fraternizing with local children. Your troops are homesick. They want to drop their guard with the kids. But children are sharp-eyed, lacking in empathy, and willing to commit atrocities their elders would shrink from. The insurgents are watching. They will notice a growing friendship between one of your people and a local child and will either harm the child as punishment or use the child against you. Similarly, stop your people from throwing candies or presents to children. It attracts them to our vehicles, creates crowds the enemy can exploit, and leads to children being run over. Harden your heart and keep the children at arm's length. 20. Take stock regularly. You probably already know that a body count tells you little, because you usually cannot know how many insurgents there were to start with, how many moved into the area, how many transferred from supporter to combatant status, or how many new fighters the conflict has created. But you still need to develop metrics early in the tour and refine them as the operation progresses. They should cover a range of social, informational, military, and economic issues. Use metrics intelligently to form an overall impression of progress, not in a mechanistic traffic light fashion. Typical metrics include percentage of engagements initiated by our forces versus those initiated by insurgents, longevity of friendly local leaders in positions of authority, number and quality of tip-offs on insurgent activity that originate spontaneously from the population, economic activity at markets and shops. These mean virtually nothing as a snapshot. Trends over time are the true indicators of progress in your sector. Author's Note, 2009. Other measures include the presence or price of exotic vegetables and fruits in market stalls, indicating that people are engaging in trade with other parts of the country. The cost of local transportation, indicating the perception of road security. The percentage of roadside bombs reported by the local people versus found by us. The collection of taxation or operation of local courts by the host nation government versus the enemy, and the level of community participation in education, public health, and agriculture programs. Again, trends over time are what matter. The actual data on any given day are much less important. Many units in Afghanistan are now experiencing success with the Tactical Conflict Assessment and Planning Framework, TCAPF, developed to help track popular perceptions and confidence. Company commanders, especially in Afghanistan, can expect to receive TCAPF training and to spend considerable effort and time collecting TCAPF data. This can be extremely valuable in identifying and resolving local sources of instability and violence. Groundhog Day. Now you are in steady state. You are established in your sector, and your people are settling into that Groundhog Day mentality that hits every unit at some stage during every tour. It will probably take people at least the first third of the tour to become effective in the environment, if not longer. Then, in the last period, you will struggle against the short-timer mentality. So this middle part of the tour is the most productive, but keeping the flame alive and bringing the local population along with you takes immense leadership. 21. Exploit a single narrative. Since counterinsurgency is a competition to mobilize popular support, it pays to know how people are mobilized. In most societies, there are opinion makers, local leaders, pillars of the community, religious figures, media personalities, and others who set trends and influence public perceptions. This influence, including the pernicious influence of the insurgents, often takes the form of a single narrative, a simple, unifying, easily expressed story or explanation that organizes people's experience and provides a framework for understanding events. Nationalist and ethnic historical myths or sectarian creeds provide such a narrative. The Iraqi insurgents have one, as do Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. To undercut their influence, you must exploit an alternative narrative, or, better yet, tap into an existing narrative that excludes the insurgents. This narrative is often worked out for you by higher headquarters, but only you have the detailed knowledge to tailor the narrative to local conditions and generate leverage from it. For example, you might use a nationalist narrative to marginalize foreign fighters in your area, or a narrative of national redemption to undermine former regime elements that have been terrorizing the population. At the company level, you do this in baby steps, by getting to know local opinion makers, winning their trust, learning what motivates them, and building on this to find a single narrative that emphasizes the inevitability and rightness of your ultimate success. This is art, not science. 22. Local forces should mirror the enemy, not ourselves. By this stage, you will be working closely with local forces, training or supporting them, and building indigenous capability. The natural tendency is to build forces in our own image, with the aim of eventually handing our role over to them. This is a mistake. Instead, local indigenous forces need to mirror the enemy's capabilities and seek to supplant the insurgents' role. This does not mean they should be irregular in the sense of being brutal or outside proper control. Rather, they should move, equip, and organize like the insurgents, but have access to your support and be under the firm control of their parent societies. Combined with a mobilized population and trusted networks, this allows local forces to hardwire the enemy out of the environment, under top cover from you. At the company level, this means that raising, training, and employing local indigenous auxiliary forces, police, and military are valid tasks. Author's Note, 2009. In operations in Iraq in 2007 and subsequently in Afghanistan, we developed what has become known as the four-component partnering model. This was expressed in the commander's guidance of June 2007 as, "Never leave home without an Iraqi." In Regional Command East in Afghanistan today, the Combined Action Program is another excellent example of this approach. In essence, the four-component model ensures that whenever and wherever we operate, at whatever size of force, four components must always be represented: coalition military, local police, and local civilian authorities. This could be as large as a coalition brigade, local battalion, police district, and local mayor, or as small as an infantry squad with a couple of local troops, a local policeman, and a representative from the local community council. Experience has shown that when we operate in this combined action manner, the performance of all four elements improves. Coalition military forces have access to language and cultural understanding and improved situational awareness through their local partners. Local military forces have access to coalition enablers, intelligence, firepower, medical support, and mobility, and have a constant example of military professionalism to emulate. Local police can no longer act corruptly or oppressively because they are continuously monitored. They can also focus on community-based policing tasks and upholding the rule of law because they are protected and supported by their military partners. And civilian officials can now access and work with the population, build credibility and connectivity by resolving local disputes, and exercise civil primacy in directing the police and local military operations when appropriate. This approach complements, but in no way replaces, the use of full-time mentors and advisors operating continuously with local police and military units through embedded training teams. This requires high-level clearance, of course, but if support is given, you should establish a company training cell. Platoons should aim to train one local squad and then use that squad as a nucleus for a partner platoon, and company headquarters should train an indigenous leadership team. This mirrors the growth process of other trusted networks and tends to emerge naturally as you win local allies who want to take up arms in their own defense. 23. Practice armed civil affairs. Counterinsurgency is armed social work, an attempt to redress basic social and political problems while being shot at. Author's Note, 2009. Some critics of the application of social science to counterinsurgency have decried this statement as a perversion of the independence and impartiality of disciplines like anthropology and sociology. While I firmly believe that these disciplines do indeed have a valid and valuable role in counterinsurgency, efforts to improve U.S. troops' cultural understanding of local societies have saved hundreds of Iraqi and Afghan lives through the Human Terrain System program, for example. I would emphasize that this article is talking about something else. Not armed social science, but social work, community organizing, welfare, mediation, domestic assistance, economic support, under conditions of extreme threat requiring armed support. This makes civil affairs a central counterinsurgency activity, not an afterthought. It is how you restructure the environment to displace the enemy from it. In your company sector, civil affairs must focus on meeting basic needs first, and then progress up Maslow's hierarchy as each successive need is met. A series of village or neighborhood surveys, regularly updated, are an invaluable tool to help understand the population's needs and to track progress in meeting them over time. You need intimate cooperation with interagency partners here, national, international, and local. You will not be able to control these partners, Many NGOs, for example, do not want to be too closely associated with you because they need to preserve their perceived neutrality. Instead, you need to work on a shared diagnosis of the problem, building a consensus that helps you self-synchronize. Your role is to provide protection, identify needs, facilitate civil affairs, and use improvements in social conditions as leverage to build networks and mobilize the population. Thus, there is no such thing as impartial humanitarian assistance or civil affairs in counterinsurgency. Every time you help someone, you hurt someone else, not least the insurgents. So civil and humanitarian assistance personnel will be targeted. Protecting them is a matter not only of close-in defense, but also of creating a permissive operating environment by co-opting the beneficiaries of aid, local communities and leaders, to help you help them. Author's Note, 2009. For aid officers and other development professionals in a counterinsurgency environment, it is important to note that there is a real qualitative difference between operating in a field environment outside a war zone and operating in a counterinsurgency environment. In normal development work, there are spoilers and local opponents to consider, but the real enemy is poverty, disease, and lack of capacity. In a counterinsurgency, all these things remain important, but there is also an enemy aid officer out there, running programs in direct competition with ours. The Taliban run agricultural teams to help farmers get the most out of the poppy crop, for example, along with local law courts and taxation programs and business advice for startup firms in the drug cultivation, gem smuggling, and timber smuggling businesses that the Taliban exploit. The presence of a competing aid program fundamentally changes the game, making everything a competitive political endeavor. This is an important point for aid agencies to consider, particularly in light of the fact that as of 2008, for the first time, more than 50% of total U.S. foreign assistance worldwide was being delivered in conflict or post-conflict zones. 24. Small is beautiful. Another natural tendency is to go for large-scale mass programs. In particular, we have a tendency to template ideas that succeed in one area and transplant them into another, and we tend to take small programs that work and try to replicate them on a larger scale. Again, this is usually a mistake. Often programs succeed because of specific local conditions of which we are unaware, or because their very smallness has kept them below the enemy's radar and helped them flourish unmolested. At the company level, programs that succeed in one district often also succeed in another, because the overall company sector is small, but small-scale projects rarely proceed smoothly into large programs. Keep programs small. This makes them cheap, sustainable, low-key, and importantly, recoverable if they fail. You can add new programs, also small, cheap, and tailored to local conditions, as the situation allows. Author's Note, 2009. Your aim should be to proliferate locally tailored versions of small programs that work, rather than to expand those programs into big programs which often fail. It should go without saying, but unfortunately does not, that local ownership and buy-in is critical in developing these local small programs. 25. Fight the enemy's strategy, not his forces. At this stage, if things are proceeding well, the insurgents will go over to the offensive. Yes, the offensive, because you have created a situation so dangerous to the insurgents by threatening to displace them from the environment that they have to attack you and the population to get back into the game. Thus, it is normal, even in the most successful operations, to have spikes of offensive insurgent activity late in the campaign. This does not necessarily mean you have done something wrong, though it may. It depends on whether you have successfully mobilized the population. At this point, the tendency is to go for the jugular and seek to destroy the enemy's forces in open battle. This is rarely the best choice at company level, because provoking major combat usually plays into the enemy's hands by undermining the population's confidence. Instead, attack the enemy's strategy. If he is seeking to recapture the allegiance of a segment of the local population, then co-opt them against him. If he is trying to provoke a sectarian conflict, go over to peace enforcement mode. The permutations are endless, but the principle is the same. Fight the enemy's strategy, not his forces. 26. Build your own solution. Only attack the enemy when he gets in the way. Try not to be distracted or forced into a series of reactive moves by a desire to kill or capture the insurgents. Your aim should be to implement your own solution, the game plan you developed early in the campaign and then refined through interaction with local partners. Your approach must be environment-centric, based on dominating the whole district and implementing a solution to its systemic problems, rather than enemy-centric. This means that, particularly late in the campaign, you may need to learn to negotiate with the enemy. Members of the population that supports you also know the enemy's leaders. They may have grown up together in the small district that is now your company sector, and valid negotiating partners sometimes emerge as the campaign progresses. Again, you need close interagency relationships to exploit opportunities to co-opt segments of the enemy. This helps you wind down the insurgency without alienating potential local allies who have relatives or friends in the insurgent movement. At this stage, a defection is better than a surrender. A surrender is better than a capture, and a capture is better than a kill. Getting short. Time is short, and the tour is drawing to a close. The key problem now is keeping your people focused, preventing them from dropping their guard, and maintaining the rage on all the multifarious programs, projects, and operations that you have started. In this final phase, the previous articles still stand, but there is an important new one. 27. Keep your extraction plan secret. The temptation to talk about home becomes almost unbearable toward the end of a tour. The locals know you are leaving and probably have a better idea than you of the generic extraction plan. Remember, they have seen units come and go. But you must protect the specific details of the extraction plan, or the enemy will use this as an opportunity to score a high-profile hit, recapture the population's allegiance by scare tactics that convince them they will not be protected once you leave, or persuade them that your successor unit will be oppressive or incompetent. Keep the details secret within a tightly controlled compartment in your headquarters and resist the temptation to say goodbye to local allies. You can always send a postcard from home. 4. What ifs? The articles above describe what should happen, but we all know that things go wrong. Here are some what-ifs to consider. What if you get moved to a different area? You prepared for Ramadi and studied Dulaim tribal structures and Sunni beliefs. Now you are going to Najaf and will be surrounded by Al-Hassan and Uniza tribes and Shia communities. But that work was not wasted. In mastering your first area, you learned techniques you can apply, how to case an operational area, how to decide what matters in the local societal structure. Do the same again, and this time the process is easier and faster, since you have an existing mental structure and can focus on what is different. The same applies if you get moved frequently within a battalion or brigade area. What if higher headquarters doesn't get counterinsurgency? Higher headquarters is telling you the mission is to kill terrorists or is pushing for high-speed armored patrols and a base camp mentality. They just do not seem to understand counterinsurgency. This is not uncommon, since company-grade officers today often have more combat experience than senior officers. In this case, just do what you can. Try not to create expectations that higher headquarters will not let you meet. apply the adage, first, do no harm. Over time, you will find ways to do what you have to do, but never lie to higher headquarters about your locations or activities. They own the indirect fires. What if you have no resources? Yours is a low priority sector. You have no linguists, the aid agencies have no money for projects in your area, you have a low priority for funding. You can still get things done, but you need to focus on self-reliance. Keep things small and sustainable, and ruthlessly prioritize effort. Local community leaders are your allies in this. They know what matters to them more than you do. Be honest with them. Discuss possible projects and options with community leaders. Get them to choose what their priority is. Often, they will find the translators, building supplies, or expertise that you need, and will only expect your support and protection in making their projects work. And the process of negotiation and consultation will help mobilize their support and strengthen their social cohesion. If you set your sights on what is achievable, the situation can still work. Author's Note, 2009. Too often, we arrive thinking we know better than the locals and foisting on communities a series of programs they neither want nor need. Then we feel offended and surprised when these programs fail. The three critical requirements for local ownership in a counterinsurgency environment are 1. Some form of transparent, local, community-based council or oversight body that assists in suggesting and monitoring projects. 2. Openly published accounts that local communities can access so that they can satisfy themselves that they are being dealt with fairly without corruption. And 3. Community involvement, ideally through jobs on a particular aid project or through the participation of local businesses. The National Solidarity Program in Afghanistan is a model of this type of program. Doing things on a commercial rather than an aid basis is also usually desirable, because aid programs are a symbol of the government and the international community and often draw unwelcome insurgent attention while increasing local people's dependency on outside support and creating vulnerability to elite capture, enabling local strongmen to control and pervert programs in their own interest. This applies mainly to development and reconstruction programs, but the same principles apply to local security programs also. What if the theater situation shifts under your feet? It is your worst nightmare. Everything has gone well in your sector, but the whole theater situation has changed and invalidates your efforts. Think of the First Battle of Fallujah, the Al-Askariya Shrine bombing, or the Sadr Uprising. What do you do? Here is where having a flexible, adaptive game plan comes in. Just as the insurgents drop down to a lower posture when things go wrong, now is the time to drop back a stage, consolidate, regain your balance, and prepare to expand again when the situation allows. If you cede the initiative, you must regain it as soon as the situation allows, or you will eventually lose. Conclusion. This, then, is the tribal wisdom, the folklore of those who went before you. Like any folklore, it needs interpretation, and it contains seemingly contradictory advice. Over time, as you apply unremitting intellectual effort to study your sector, you will learn to apply these ideas in your own way, and you will add to this store of wisdom from your own observations and experience. So only one article remains. If you remember nothing else, remember this. 28. Whatever else you do, keep the initiative. In counterinsurgency, the initiative is everything. If the enemy is reacting to you, you control the environment. Provided you mobilize the population, you will win. If you are reacting to the enemy, even if you are killing or capturing him in large numbers, then he is controlling the environment, and you will eventually lose. In counterinsurgency, the enemy initiates most attacks, targets you unexpectedly, and withdraws too fast for you to react. Do not be drawn into purely reactive operations. Focus on the population, build your own solution, further your game plan, and fight the enemy only when he gets in the way. This gains and keeps the initiative.